Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, breaking news. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is about to sign legislation passed by the legislature to stop lab-grown meat from human consumption in the state of Florida. A coalition called Stop Global Elites, Save Our Beef in the state of Florida. It's called SB1084. It's going to keep lab-grown meat out of the state of Florida. Governor DeSantis has said, quote, they want you to believe that consuming insects is an overlooked source of protein and a way to battle climate change. And he's going after lab-grown meat first. Florida has had enough of that. Now, this is interesting. As a conservative, libertarian, anti-regulatory, should lab-grown meat be banned from Florida? I don't know. I do know that people need to be aware of it, what it is. There's a lot of potential health dangers with it. First of all, it's highly processed. They're getting the stem cells from pig, sheep, cow, mixing it with fetal blood, putting it into a petri dish, and then adding texture, additives, coloring, making like white. I've seen the videos. In fact, I got to show you the videos. I got to bring those for the program. And we'll have video tomorrow of Ron DeSantis talking about this banning of lab-grown meat. Anyway, my point is, I'm not sure I'm 100% sure of banning it. I want to point out that Bill Gates is buying up farmland, that Richard Branson and Bill Gates are employing billions of dollars to research lab-grown meat, that Bill Gates wants all animal agriculture off farming in the entire Western world. He wants to move the farms into the laboratories, which, of course, he and other billionaires will supervise. And they want you to eat this 3D printed lab-grown meat. It's frightening stuff. And the United States Federal Department of Agriculture in 2023 approved lab-grown meat for the first time ever in U.S. history for human consumption. So given all that, I don't know the deal. This is breaking news. So I don't know the vagaries of this bill, if it's like pending further study. We shall fight back, but here's some of the stuff that they're promoting. And Ron DeSantis, Florida has fought back against the inhumane ideas of the global elites, passed legislation to protect farmlands. That's good. From being bought by Chinese Communist Party and its interests. That's good. Implemented policies to prevent central bank digital currency from being recognized in Florida. That is fantastic. Put an end. I like regulations against government tyranny. I like outright bans against that. Lab-grown meat, I'm not 100% sold on banning it, because if someone wants to eat lab-grown meat, crap, let them. Put an end to woke banks denying or canceling financial services for Floridians who hold different political views. So totally support that, because the banks are working corporate government collusion. Protected Floridians from government tracking a credit card transaction related to the purchase of firearms. Totally support that. So he's doing great. He goes on and modernized the Right to Farm Act to protect our agriculture activities from frivolous lawsuits. We're at the point now where school children could probably shut down farms by saying they're hurting the climate, they're methane, and we can't have this high yield agriculture. So this is good that they're protecting him from lawsuits. Signed legislation to ensure agritourism operations qualify for protected taxes, assessments, simplified steps for Florida farmers to receive tax exemptions for agricultural materials. Make no mistake, they are coming after our food supply with restrictions. And in that vein, I'm going to show you clip two. This is the globalist disturbing plan to take over our food supply. You know, maybe DeSantis should be banning lab-grown meat. I just need more data, but my hesitation, I'm opposed to lab-grown meat. I'm opposed to this. I'm more opposed to how they're getting it to the point where they could do it, so they could sell it. Not so much banning the sale. Maybe I'm arguing an esoteric, ideological, anti-regulatory stance that's not as relevant. But anyway, let's watch clip two. This woman is giving you a disturbing plan to take over, the globalist plan to take over our food supply.
Here's what you need to understand. One of the reasons I'm working and I'm so committed to preventing financial transaction control is that is what they are planning on to feed you synthetic lab-grown meat. No one in their right mind would ever eat this stuff. But the reality is what they're hoping is that is that, you know, once they have control of your transactions, they can dictate your health policies and they can dictate what food you can and cannot buy. So if they don't want you buying pizza, you can't buy pizza. If they want you to buy pizza made with insect-based flour, that's what you're going to get. That's one of the reasons they want this kind of control. And remember, you had John Kerry saying, you know, we ought to get rid of all the farmers. They're literally planning on getting rid of all the farmers and instituting, you know, food created synthetically in manufacturing laboratories. You have to read it. And one of the reasons you have to read it is the reason to stop them from putting your farmers and fishermen out of business and pushing them off their land is if they succeed in doing that, you and I will be eating lab-grown meat. That's their plan.
And but not for people like that goober John Kerry and for the World Economic Forum.
No, they'll be flying around
in a bikini on the beach.
Right. They'll be flying around on jets.
Eating good food. Somewhere they'll have it secretly so they can get good, you know, ribeye steaks and good, you know, filet mignons and great, you know, clean food and don't have to take the vaccine because, you know, they're special.
Right. Now, the alternative is if you look at what they're doing with the healthcare policies and the injections, you know, they're assuming there are going to be a lot less of us.
Yes, that's a frightening thought. That was Catherine Austin Fitz, who's been following this agricultural policy and the food policy of our elites. We have to wake up, and she's exactly right. They want to end animal agriculture. They want to end farming. They want this to be lab food grown in labs, not just meat, other things. They have lab-grown fish, by the way. They're talking about even growing all the vegetables and crops in laboratories, not in agriculture, because then they can control the emissions by carbon offsets. And again, this is not going to be small-time farmers. They're not going to be able to do this. They're going to be wiped out. This is going to be big corporate equity asset, multinational corporations running the food supply. Frightening, frightening, frightening. I'm going to give you an example, historic example. This is really well done. How Canada convinced you to eat engine lubricant. This is by Paul Salido. He's a doctor, and he's talking about canola oil, which I find fascinating because you think like, oh, that sounds like a good oil to eat. And if we've had people on this program before talking about all these oils, actually any oil, even olive oil is still not good. Juices. You know, you drink a grapefruit or orange juice or apple juice, not as good as the whole fruit. And some of these are just completely fraudulent oils, you know, like a vegetable oil. I was joking with one of my guests, what do they do? Squeeze broccoli and they get oil out of it. Oh, that's vegetable oil. That's good. No, it's not. It's highly processed. So let's take a look at how Canada convinced you to eat engine lubricant. This is Paul Saladino, doctor in Canada. Very well done.
This is how Canada convinced you to eat engine lubricant. This is the crazy history of canola oil. Canola oil is derived from the seeds of the rape plant. It's rape seed oil. And it was originally developed in World War II to lubricate ships and steam engines because the oil sticks to wet metal. Now, during World War II, the United States needed to build a lot of ships. And we didn't really have enough of this rape seed oil to lubricate the parts that were going to get wet. So the US government asked Canada to increase their production of rape seed oil to help with the war effort. But at the end of World War II, demand for this rapeseed oil dropped precipitously, and Canada needed to find a way to keep selling something it had put so many resources into producing in high amounts. The problem for Canada immediately after the war is that this unmodified rapeseed oil is toxic for humans, containing significant amounts of a monounsaturated fat called erucic acid, which seems to be damaging for the heart. But in 1980, scientists finally succeeded in genetically modifying the seeds from these rape plants to make their oil significantly lower in erucic acid, and canola oil was born. Canola is actually an acronym that stands for Canadian Oil Low Acid, and today it's one of the most highly consumed oils on the planet, and especially in the United States. And if you listen to mainstream health authorities or the American College of Cardiology, they'll tell you this oil is healthy for you. But I beg to differ. There are multiple studies in both animal and human models showing clearly that seed oils like canola oil are harmful for us. Another problem with canola oil and other seed oils is that in order to get these oils from the seeds of plants, they must be highly refined, exposed to many extracting agents that are carcinogenic like benzene, hexane, and heated to high high temperatures leading to oxidation of these fragile oils. And exposure to high heat in the distillation process leads to oxidation and the formation of significant amounts of trans fats. So these oils are toxic in so many different ways. So don't be fooled by propaganda here or what you're told by mainstream health authorities. These oils are harmful for humans. They should never have become part of our food supply. In fact, I don't even think of them as food. The only thing they're good for is engine lubricants, and that's the way they should stay.
You know, 5 years ago, I would have said, oh, he's probably one of those natural health people. We have the best diet. We have the longest life expectancy. We're the best health. People are healthier than ever. I no longer believe that. I think we are living longer historically, although our life expectancy has been dropping recently, but we're chronically ill. RFK Jr.'s message has sunk through to me. And I think a lot of this is we're over-vaccinated, we're over-processed food, we're overweight. I would like to get the author of the book that changed my life, dietarily, not even a word, but dietarily speaking, I'll use it anyway, the language, the living language, flexible language. His name was Stephen Gullo, who wrote The Thin Commandments. He's a food strategist. And I'm not trying to promote the book. I have nothing in it, but I don't mean to try to promote it, but the book changed my life because I had lost probably 60, 70 pounds, high point 80 pounds from reading the book, from years of yo-yo dieting. You can see old videos of me, much bigger. And the key of the book that actually worked wasn't, oh, you got to eat healthy, you got to eat processed food, you got to eat red meat. He's a food strategist. The whole strategy was, it was about getting yourself thinner and healthier, meaning losing the excess weight, not necessarily eating healthy, which is important because he recommends diet drinks and stuff that I wouldn't even drink now, but I was back then. This is 2014. In fact, it's been 2013. So it's been exactly 11 years that I lost the weight and kept it off. I could always lose the weight, but never keep it off. But anyway, the point of the food strategist is you have strategies in which you can eat healthy. You don't like, oh, I got you. If you're going to have a candy bar or something sweet, you do it after a meal. You don't want to eat it on an empty stomach. Yeah, you can have a Snickers bar if it's within your dietary budget, but you don't eat it straight alone because then it sends your blood sugar hike and then crashing and causes cravings. And he goes through the whole thing about, you know, tiny little meals. I travel with like a food, you know, essential food. So you don't, if you're traveling, because that's when I'd always get off my diet, so to speak. And you travel. So when you're traveling, you're not relying on what does the airplane have or what can I get at a food stand or there's a fast food. I got nothing else to eat. I'm starving. I have no reason you should be starving. If you can start thinking as food is important and the what you eat is important and when you eat it and all of that. You know, the healthy eating can come even later. And I'm saying you could actually eat junk and lose weight on this diet if you do it, right? It's all about food strategies and how to psychologically deal with all the triggers. Box out certain foods, you know, donuts, Krispy Kreme, maple ice cream donuts were my problem. I still eat them, but I won't go there and get, you know, eat nine of them like I could have. I think that was my record. These are really high fat donuts. Anyway, so the food issue is a huge issue, and people they're transforming our diet, and they're doing it in the name of net zero and deprivation. The earth can't handle it, et cetera. Okay, so this was a great speech. This is geologist Gregory Wrightstone at the 2024 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. I spoke there last year on the Great Reset. He spoke there this year on climate. And he was talking about how using the climate agenda to come after our freedoms, your freedom to choose what you eat. This is Gregory Wrightstone at the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Take a look, clip three.
What they're doing right now, because of these false claims, they're trying to restrict your freedoms. They're trying to control every single aspect of your life. They've already regulated away incandescent bulbs. They've already told you how much water can be used in your toilet, how much water comes out of your shower. Now they're trying to regulate what you can drive, how you heat your home, and just every other aspect of your life. Why? Because of this demonization of carbon dioxide. So let's take a look at it. Before the Industrial Revolution, I'm not going to give you too many numbers. It was 280 parts per million. Today it's 420, and it's from burning fossil fuels. And I'm okay with that because you can see that CO2 increases are hugely beneficial. And I enjoy living a high carbon lifestyle, and I'm going to continue doing it. And I sleep well at night.
I love that. And that's my message. Enjoy living a high carbon lifestyle. Carbon dioxide is plant food. We inhale oxygen as humans. We exhale carbon dioxide. And some of these frightening net zero reports, government funded, like the one in UK, I referenced this on a show earlier this week, the UK fires report. They want to regulate carbon dioxide like similar to asbestos. Human breath is going to become toxic. We've had peer-reviewed studies saying human breath is a warming agent, and Africans have more warming agents in their breath than Asians, and women have more warming agents than men. Incredible stuff. But kudos to the great speech there by geologist Gregory Wrightstone, who's a friend of the show, been on the show several times. Okay, this is funny because the solution to this so-called crisis is this is a sustainable off-the-grid festival celebrating the reliability of solar power, but they're forced to use a huge diesel generator because the sun isn't shining. Let's watch clip four.
So this is kind of just too funny. I'm at the Off-Grid Living Festival, and this is the Commodore Off-Grid and Solar Pumping Specialists. They've got massive solar arrays, but you might be able to hear something in the background, and in fact, you might be able to see something pumping out of an exhaust pipe there, because classic, cloudy day, and they're trying to supply power to the various tents and things, and the result is that you are literally ending up with smoked cheese. It's lovely cheese, by the way, these guys, but it's now getting smoked. Diesel smoked cheese doesn't seem to be the best advertisement for the power of solar. Just so you'd get a laugh out of it. I am, I mean, I get it, these things happen, but I'm just kind of enjoying the delicious irony.
And that was Australian filmmaker Topher Field, who actually interviewed me about 10 years ago in DC for a great documentary he did about climate. He did a series of long form interviews just debunking the entire climate emergency, green energy scam. Topher Field, what a great thing. And you know, who else did this very similar? Michael Moore, the left-wing filmmaker, in his film Planet of the Humans. He got exiled from Planet of the Progressives when he did his film. And he showed the same thing, the diesel generators running at the green energy show, and what a fraud it was. Best part of that movie, and I don't know how he found it. I've never seen the clip. It's an awesome clip. It's Richard Branson and Al Gore being interviewed by some local news reporter at some climate conference. And they asked him, is Al Gore a prophet? They asked Richard Branson, the billionaire. Again, he's working with Bill Gates and funding lab-grown meat. And he turns to Al Gore and he says, it depends on how you spell the word profit. And they both have this hearty chuckle, kind of like knowingly, like, hey, we're philanthrocapitalists. We're making money off this green energy. It was a really telling moment. And Michael Moore really exposed that. And again, he got banned. His movie got censored. You take it off YouTube. I mean, it was incredible. Incredible film. You know, parts of it I didn't agree with, a lot of the ideology, but he really nailed his end of his politics on his side. He is fearless in that regard. Okay, final clip. Actress Drew Barrymore, who I got to meet 2 years ago in Washington, D.C., had my picture, chatted with her briefly, was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I was a guest of Newsmax TV, Chris Reddy. And she's actually very attractive and very pleasant and friendly. But here she is with Vice President Kamala Harris on her show and from Hollywood, Drew Barrymore, the actress from E.T. fame and other shows, saying, we need you to be the Mamala of the country. She's just sort of pandering to Kamala Harris. So here's Drew Barrymore, clip five.
I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
The Mamala of the country. Okay, I should have the clip tomorrow with Howard Stern telling Joe Biden he's the father of the country and he's been a great dad, both to his family and to us, the citizens of the United States as president. Hollywood seems to be enamored with this mother-father-parent complex that we turn to government for our parenting. Of course, Hillary Clinton was too. It takes a village, not a family, to raise a kid. In 1993, for Rush Limbaugh's television show, I went to the, it wasn't the White House correspondents, it was the radio TV congressional correspondents dinner. And I interviewed this guy with a long, let me correct that. It was 1993, it was the congressional, but Rush Limbaugh, it was at a previous debate forum before Bill Clinton ran. Guy with a ponytail stood up and said, "You will be president. You are our father of the nation when you win," talking to Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton embraced that. He'd be the father of the country. Well, I asked a bunch of all the reporters, including Britt Hume, about that question about the ponytail guy, as Rush Limbaugh used to call him. And Britt Hume gave a really funny answer at the time, saying he's not my father and this guy with the ponytail. Rush Limbaugh loved it. They've written that clip over and over. This has been steeped in American politics, is my point, going back decades at the president. I mean, I guess George Washington, the father of our nation, but they don't mean it that way. They really mean it like they want to be taken care of in a sort of COVID way, told what they can and can't do, treated like toddlers, like sit down, shut up, stand further apart, put your mask on, get this shot. You have no choice. You have no say in the matter. We're closing your school. Stay at home. That's how these Hollywood celebrities mean that. All right. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Lee Habib, creator and host of American Stories, a podcast weekly syndicated radio show. We're going to be talking about the politics of New Jersey, Governor Murphy, taxation. I want to ask him about electoral politics there. Also, the COVID handling. And New Jersey was one of the more insane states when it came to COVID policy. But when we come back, we're going to have Lee Habib, host of our American Stories, joining us. Stay tuned. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
90,000 elderly patients were removed from hospitals in 2020. 93% of those patients were moved into care homes owned by two companies, HC1 and Barchester. Both of those companies have their accounts in the Cayman Islands. Are you smelling a rat yet? That rat's going to get really big in a minute. 83% of those that died of COVID were given 5 to 7 times the dose of midazolam. They were given it with morphine, which increases the effects of each drug when you give them together. It's a synergistic effect.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're joined now by Lee Habib, creator and host of Our American Stories, a podcast weekly syndicated radio show. All right. You're a New Jersey native. We're going to talk to you about some of the things going on in that state. And now, of course, you've exiled the state. Let's first of all talk about why you exiled. Why are you no longer living in the Garden State of New Jersey?
Well, it's many of us have moved out. In fact, for the last 6 years, New Jersey has been number one in a bunch of dubious things. But the worst of them is the United Van Line survey. You see, United knows a lot about where people are moving to and where they're moving from. And they are fleeing New Jersey at a faster rate than any other state in the country. And of course, the runners up are California and Connecticut. And we know why. We're refugees. We're refugees from the high tax confiscatory state and the state capitals, in particular here, Trenton. And we're seeking better treatment of our capital, of our lives, of our businesses. And my, you know, my Italian and Lebanese grandparents came to America for the same reason. They wanted to be treated better than their home governments. And now you're having this happen all over America. This bodes well for conservatives, because in the end, the electoral college will start to take and shape in ways that are very unpredictable. You know, Mark, a lot of people predicted when all the people from New York and New Jersey went to Florida, for instance, that Florida would invariably turn blue. But Florida has turned redder over the past 10 years. And this is a fact of life, I believe, in a lot of these states going forward. We're not going to return back to these confiscatory rates. We're going to remember why we left those states.
Yeah, and do you think a lot of it is the conservatives and libertarians outraged and they leave and they take their conservative politics to the new state? The question is, does New Jersey get more liberal as people leave because only the diehard liberals stay? How does that work?
Well, I think it's that. I also think some people just have to stay. They don't have the ability to move. Moreover, sometimes they'll say, look, the high taxes are one thing, but my grandmother lives next door and she's sick. I do know this. The fewer people you get to tax, the more you have to tax the remaining people. Mark, it's just simple math, right? And these people already had rapacious appetites. The public pension system in New Jersey does not care how many people left or how many people came. They want one thing at the end of every year, more money.
Now, New Jersey, in political circles, you have Governor Phil Murphy there now. You had, I can't remember his name, but the man who came out as homosexual, gay, and years ago, maybe 15 years ago, and then you had Chris Christie. You have some interesting political figures. What is the story with New Jersey politics in terms of your governors? Phil Murphy, well, I want to talk to you about his COVID policies. But first of all, Chris Christie, is he beloved in that state?
No, he was hated by the time he left because he messed with the public pension system. He tried to reform it. Give Christie credit. Yeah. He tried to go in there. He actually told the story of the public pension system, I think, better than almost any governor in history. And there are a lot of things I don't like about Christie on the national level. But on the state level, by the way, this is not ancient history that he won, right? You're talking 2010, which means New Jersey isn't quite as liberal as we think. It's just more liberal than it wishes it would be. And a lot of this has to do with the problem it has with property taxes. So in comes Christie to tell the story of the indebtedness of each family to the state of New Jersey and to all these public pension owners who are seeking their money no matter what the state of the economy of each of the individual American families' lives. Christie went in there, tried to do the job, and they killed him. They killed him.
I remember liking when Christie ran in 2012, I was very impressed with him because of his impromptu ability to debate union leaders and his handling of the media. He really was impressive as a governor. And then once he ran for president, you realized in many ways he was sort of like a Mitt Romney, or he was more the establishment. And I became quickly disillusioned with him. But so you're saying all that battles against those public pension, the unions, he didn't actually get anywhere? Was there any lasting legacy of his battles?
Marginally, Mark, for a short term, but in the end, it's a machine and it kills. And then it re-elects whoever supports it. It's just, it's terrible, but it's a tragedy, actually. You know, I told a story in that Newsweek essay. I wrote an essay about essentially this great shift. You know, Billy Joel wrote a song in 1977 called Moving Out. And the line that we New Jerseyans remember rather despondently was, who needs a house out in Hackensack? Is that all you get for your money? That was 1977, Mark. You know, when my mom died, my dad said, I got to pack up the house and I've got to leave. And I said, Dad, what's the problem? And he wouldn't get into it with me. So what I did is I started going through a little bit of his tax records. And I said, Dad, you're a history teacher. Tell me the history of New Jersey taxes, because it was clear that's why he was leaving. And let me tell you, the story he told me, Mark, was amazing, particularly about the state income tax. My dad pointed out that we've been a state for 200 years and had managed never to have a state income tax until 1976. Two centuries without one. And the debate was fierce. A New York Times headline was fierce debate in the New Jersey House and Senate in the state legislature over a 1% income tax. Can you imagine that today, right? And
then I bet it's still 1%, right? They haven't raised it.
Of course, Mark. It's never gone up. And then he took me through the history of the, like, just a simple thing. Like, you're living in northern New Jersey and you just want to go see a play in New York. You love living close to the big city. And the George Washington Bridge's toll was $1 in 1976. It's $17 now, Mark. 17 big ones. Where is it going? The gas tax, one of the highest gas tax in the country. The state of New Jersey takes in more money per barrel than Exxon does. So another slight, but the biggest one was property taxes. My dad told me the story. He bought a house in 1961, Mark, for $30,000. And he didn't even remember his first property tax bill because it was that insignificant. But yes. I know why he moved. And I know the tax bill he did remember, $12,500 10 years ago for a $350,000 house. And what my dad said is, if you would have told me in 1961 that my property taxes in 2.5 years would be as much as what I paid for my entire house, I would have told you you were smoking something. Moreover, my dad pointed out that his generation paid off their houses right away. My dad was a 10-year mortgage guy, not a 15, not a 20, a 10-year mortgage guy. We lived with tenants upstairs and created a two-family house so my dad could pay down that nut. But he said, you know what? I have a landlord. My landlord is the state of New Jersey. My paid off house is actually owned by the state. And if I don't pay the property taxes, they'll take my house. I'm out of here.
Wow. You know, I had the same thing growing up in Fairfax County, Virginia. My dad, 1987, was paying something like $10,000 on a house worth maybe $200,000 or $300,000. And it was the same thing. We had a property tax revolt. And of course, like you said, the revolt worked briefly, but the system seems to always win. The Leviathan of government always ends up steamrolling the opposition and continuing their trek. But what you were talking about in New Jersey, what I talked about in Virginia, this is particularly all throughout the Northeast. I mean, is New York's probably not much different, not much better, right? And Pennsylvania seems to be following suit now with their string of, you know, political decisions of late. You know, they had governors trying to get them in climate regulatory commissions and other things like that. Tell us about Phil Murphy, the current governor of New Jersey. I understand, first of all, he almost lost his last election, and I don't even know the guy's name. He was such a nobody. But tell us who Phil Murphy is and what happened and what made him so unpopular that he almost lost to an unknown political opponent.
Well, the same problems. The people of New Jersey, when polled recently, 60% of them said they would move out. 60% said they would move out or plan to move out. So the dissatisfaction is still that same problem, Mark. It's the taxes. It's the cost of living plus inflation on top of that. The problem is Phil wins again because the other guy, just even if he had gotten in, Christie experienced this. It's this Leviathan. In the end, even when you win, you lose because that public pension system has entrenched special interests attached to it. It's every teacher. It's all the staffers. The public schools, if you add up the entire population that employs public schools, I know my dad was a superintendent of schools in his town. They were by far the biggest employer. You add the janitors together, and they all vote in a block because that school is their interest. Now, there are some conservative teachers, no doubt. There are some conservative, you know, people who work in the maintenance departments. But the survival of that school system is predicated on a few things. Automatic big pay increases, healthy and beautiful retirement packages. And by the way, once you're given one, if somebody gave me a retirement package like that, I'd fight for the dickens to keep it. The retirement packages aren't ordinary retirement packages like yours or mine. But my dad doesn't pay a bill for his prescription drugs. His copays are all, that's right, he doesn't have a copay. So imagine having these gold-plated public pensions and having these pensions that are easily, Christie had explained to one citizen once that the average school teacher, the average public employee pension beneficiary had a pension valued with traditional lifespans of over $3 million. That's not counting Social Security. Ask your average New Jersey resident if they have $3 million worth of pension, and they don't. They're lucky if they have a few hundred thousand dollars in their 401k. So this is the dissonance. And this is why people ultimately move. If they can't beat the system, when they get a chance, they'll move. Or some of these big plants moved. Mercedes of North America, for instance, they were in Bergen County, had a lot of friends who worked. These were good white collar jobs, Mark. This wasn't the manufacturing plant. This was the marketing and sales division of this great German corporation. They kept telling the governor, look, we're going to go if you don't do something about these property taxes, because we've got to pay those taxes. You see, we've got to pay the employees enough to live in New Jersey. So he called their bluff. And you know what they did? They moved to Sandy Springs, Georgia. And by the way, when I called those folks up 3 years ago to ask how that went, the workers and some of the executives there who I knew, they said, well, you know, first I thought the South was going to have Klansmen around every corner. Wasn't going to be good food. And then I realized it's nicer. It's warmer. I don't have to pay a toll on every road. And I'm getting a 30% pay increase, because that's what it all translated into when you looked at the cost of housing and the taxes. 30% more of discretionary income for simply moving a few hundred miles south.
Well, isn't this the beauty of federalism? You can have these insane policies in states like New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, and people can just vote with their feet and go to other states that are more welcoming to what they're doing. So in a way, don't New Jerseyites deserve this fate because they allowed this to happen? I mean, that's kind of a cruel way of saying it, but is there any truth to that?
I see the people in New Jersey. I'm Arab. I'm Arabic, of Arabic descent. I see the people in New Jersey like I see the people of Gaza. They're hostages. They're hostages to evil forces. And over time, those poor people of Gaza are both propagandized, used as victims, and then periodically Hamas throws some pebbles their way, like the old mafia used to do down on Mott Street. We're the good guys. Meanwhile, they're holding a gun to my grandfather's head, who owns a pizzeria in Brooklyn, so he can take that money and spread it around. I know mobsters. They affected my family. In Brooklyn. And the mob did affect a lot of Italian families. They didn't just protect those Italian businesses. They shook them down, especially if you own a restaurant. You're going to use this garbage service. You're going to use this pizza sauce, or you're dead. It's just very simple. Oh, and by the way, if you do well, you need a little protection money from us. Well, who am I getting protected from? From us. Dead. It's just very simple. Oh, and by the way, if you do well, you need a little protection money from us. Well, who am I getting protected from? From us. And I believe this is the same in New Jersey. These are almost quasi-mobsters, these public pension unions. They represent themselves only. And we are not at the negotiating table, regrettably. And, you know, even Roosevelt, FDR, the great FDR to Democrats, was against public pension unions. And he was against them because he understood that they'd become a beast. And pretty soon they'd be serving themselves and not the government or the citizens. They would simply be self-serving interests. New Jersey's got one of the biggest, strongest, and toughest and meanest public pension unions in the country. And this is not a slam against the teachers. There are a lot of good people who are teachers. My dad was one, but he didn't mind taking the pay increases. Why wouldn't he?
Yeah, I can understand that. Well, Quinn, I've seen every episode of The Sopranos, and you say you knew mobsters. That takes place in New Jersey, obviously. Is The Sopranos an accurate representation of how the mob operated vis-a-vis small business and then the culture in New Jersey, or is it Hollywood fiction?
I've never seen anything more accurate in my whole life. It also captured the mob at the point they were post-Rico. Because it was very difficult. Once RICO occurred, and this is a RICO, it's a racketing and corruption federal statute that basically said, if you're in an organization that commits a murder, you all commit the murder. So it used to be that the guy who committed murder went away, but John Gotti got off, right? Or the big guys got off. But now, as you remember in The Godfather, there was that great line, were there buffers? You know, there were a lot of buffers. Well, RICO shattered that. And now you actually get to put the whole mob away. So Sopranos was sort of a look at the mob in its last gasps. The heydays were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where the Gambino family had 2,000, 3,000 foot soldiers. And these five families ran New York. Every ounce of concrete, you name it, it moved. It was Teamsters. By the year 2000, they were robbing some trucks. The units were small, and they were carving up a smaller and smaller percentage of the pie. As the big gangsters, the unions took the money instead.
If I recall, there was maybe an episode in the later episodes of The Sopranos where one of the mobsters go into it was some kind of chain retail outlet.
It was a coffee shop.
Yeah, and they try to shake him down. And they're like, well, I'm just the manager here. I don't know. You'd have to talk to corporate. And it was like the whole world had changed and these mobsters weren't keeping up. They couldn't shake down this large corporation. It was very funny.
I remember, it was a 19-year-old manager and they kept threatening him. And he was like crying. He goes, look, I can't do anything. And if you remember at the end, Paulie Walnuts takes some coffee off the stack, sticks it steals something, and then as he gets out, there's no place left for the little guy anymore. He was lamenting that he can't shake down a local store.
Wow. Well, okay, in terms of how do you reform this public pension system, a state like New Jersey? I mean, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, it'll be the same system, same thing operating. Do you see any changes coming? You had Chris Christie try to stop it. Is this literally the nearest thing to eternal life on earth? Are these public pensions?
No, look, I think what happens is a quick story about, I remember writing a profile, The Death of an American City. It happened 2 or 3 years ago. I wrote it for National Review, a really long essay about the death of Detroit. In 1960, Detroit had the highest per capita income of any city in the country. Number one, who would have thought? Anybody who was an engineer worth his salt was moving near Detroit to sell the parts, the assembly, anything having to do the manufacturing of our great automobile industry. There was no Toyota. There was no room for anybody to compete. We were market dominant. Best symphony orchestra in America, growing suburbs, great schools. Who would have ever thought in a mere 50 years that the city would face bankruptcy proceedings? Which it did. And luckily for the state of Michigan, an emerging city, Grand Rapids, was growing and it walled itself off from the problems and perils of Detroit. So Grand Rapids got a lot of that business. Detroit went broke. And I just worry with New Jersey that there aren't these walls. So I think 20, 30 years from now, what's going to happen is simple. More and more people leave. Taxes go higher and higher. There's not enough money to pay. There has to be either a bankruptcy or a bankruptcy reorganization in which the people of New Jersey, the public pension folks in New Jersey, have to take a haircut or they have nothing. And in the interim, all of the flight from New Jersey, from California, is, I believe, going to reshape the electoral map in ways no one even comprehends.
Now, a lot of aren't some of the wealthiest counties in the United States in New Jersey, so many wealthy people. The question is, are they avoiding some of these state taxes by saying registering a house in Florida, living there the certain amount, claiming they live there a certain amount of time? How much wealth is in New Jersey? It seems like you do have some of the wealthiest counties near New York City and some of the wealthiest people and celebrities living there.
No, well, there's no doubt. And look, what happens with the people with that kind of wealth is they have ways of avoiding taxes, right? When it's real wealth, like, but not the ordinary guy, like a partner in a law firm making $800,000 a year. I'm not talking that kind of wealth. I'm talking hedge fund guys. I'm talking the big dollars. But even Paul Singer running one of the biggest hedge funds in all of New York City at a certain point went, look, if you're going to start hitting our capital gains, if you're going to start hitting us where we live, we're out of Dodge too. And Elliot and Associates, which employed like 1,000 people, average salary like $800,000, took it like it's 800 employees. They're now in West Palm Beach or Miami right now. They left too. So you have to be very careful. A lot of these multimillionaires don't mind paying the extra taxes, some of them, because they just feel virtuous, right? And they can afford it. They're in businesses that have very large margins. You know, if you're in some businesses where the money's coming in, you go, oh, so I pay half. No big deal. But if you own 3 or 4 7-Elevens, this is a big deal. And so the rank and file and the small business owners getting creamed, a lot of these tech guys, and New York has a huge and growing tech sector. It's got Wall Street where the super bonuses come in once a year, and it's multi-millions. And they don't want to leave New York. They're willing to pay the extra price because they can afford it. But I actually believe what happened with Paul Singer is about to happen more and more, because at a certain point, even the rich go enough is enough.
All right, we had to take a break. We're talking with Lee Habib, creator and host of Our American Stories, a podcast weekly syndicated radio show. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll have more after this message.
I'm Nyheim Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care. And they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve. Healing. Nurturing, rescuing, protecting, inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations has never been more important, and it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. The Nonprofit Alliance.
From wars to censorship to cultural issues, you're with Mark Morano and Unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Lee Habib, creator and host of Our American Stories podcast and weekly radio show. And we're talking about New Jersey here, that's where he's from, which my personal note is I had an uncle, cousins in New Jersey, Madison, New Jersey, I would always go to. And we'd go to Atlantic City. And I was in Atlantic City back in the 70s, pre-gambling as a kid. And my brother lives near Giant Stadium in New Jersey. He also lived in Hoboken. So I would go annual treks to New Jersey. And then Jersey beaches. My wife's from Philadelphia, so I've been to Ocean City, New Jersey. Just one question. Atlantic City, I have not been in a decade. And I used to go all the time in the 80s, 90s, up into the early 2000s. Whatever happened, gambling is everywhere. Is Atlantic City just collapsed, or is it still sitting as a gambling mecca? What is the status of that? Just out of curiosity.
It's somewhere in between, like it is in the Gulf Coast. It has harmed them, but still, for all the day trippers, it's still viable. There are some thriving casinos there, but nothing like the roaring days of the 70s and 80s, where it was Vegas or it was Atlantic City, and that was it. So now you've got Connecticut casinos, Pennsylvania, because they're everywhere. There's probably a casino in your backyard, Mark. Who knows?
Yeah, we have them in a county in Virginia. They're in West Virginia. They're in D.C. They're everywhere, which I don't support for the same reasons. Not that I don't support it because they're usually government, you know, they have to be commissioned by the government and they get tax revenues and the government sells it as a way we get more revenue. Well, I don't want the government getting more revenue because more revenue means more spending and more spending means needing more revenue. And of course it's a vice tax and everything else. Anyway, aside from that. Okay. Just real quick on New Jersey's, tell us about Governor Murphy and the COVID policy. He was a national figure during COVID. I know there was all these New Jersey gyms. He was one of the governors who a few other governors too, but refused to allow gyms open during a alleged health crisis. We want everyone to stay at home and order takeout and get fat and watch Netflix. No gyms. What in the hell was your governor thinking? And why was he so vulnerable then? Is that part of the reason in the last election he almost lost?
Look, it was a huge part of it, And the same with Whitmer. And these are traditional people who would vote for him. That and the taxes made it rough. And yet still he triumphed. You know, he was one of the worst. He and Cuomo and Newsom on all indicators. ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, actually put together a three-tier look at which states did the best and which did the worst. One was on deaths per citizen, and particularly as they age. The other was the economic vitality. And the last was the health of the children. And New Jersey was like one of the last and one of the worst. And Florida, where Governor Death Sentence was, remember that's what the New York Times called him? Governor Death Sentence had one of the best results. And one of the oldest populations. And the old people were the ones doing the dying, mostly, in this COVID crisis. That's what we learned very quickly, that if we had just done what DeSantis had done and Kemp had done, isolate the old, right, and let the rest of us carry on with our lives. And Sweden just stayed open, and they had a little higher death count in the first month or two. But after the fact, They had by far the best performance. And what did they do? Nothing.
Yeah. Now what happened was, I'm in Virginia. So we had Terry McAuliffe, the 800 pound gorilla, was going to crush the GOP opposition here. And he brought in the teachers union, what's her name, Weingartner, to come in. And they were pushing, you know, the school closing, masking of children. Terry McAuliffe ran on the vaccine mandates expanding in Virginia and everything else. And it was the same time that the Governor Murphy was running in New Jersey. Well, McAuliffe goes down. Phil Murphy almost goes down. The New York Times then reports that the Democrat Party does a internal focus group, and they find out that even the base, liberal Democrat base, was tired of the COVID lockdowns and mask mandates and vaccine mandates. And do you know, because of your New Jersey Governor Murphy almost losing, and because of Terry McAuliffe getting booted, that every major city was so spooked by those two elections that from LA to San Francisco to Philadelphia to Detroit to Boston to Washington all lifted the mask mandates and vaccine mandates shortly after they did those focus groups because of that close election in New Jersey and the defeat of the Democrat Party machine in Virginia. I want to thank the New Jerseyites for suffering like that, but they actually did end all that insanity and COVID theater in all those major Northeast cities.
Yeah, Governor Murphy performed a public service in the end for the rest of us living in all the other states. So thank you again, Governor Murphy.
Those gym owners, I mean, they were getting fined. I remember the one point where they couldn't have it open, so they put them out in the parking lot. Why was he such a stickler on the gyms? Is he just a wannabe authoritarian? Tyrant? Couldn't wait for the power? Is that what?
You know how the media works. Look, I always think about that girl at Budweiser who hired, you know, Dylan Mulvaney. And if you remember, she filmed herself. Why did she film herself? For her friends, to virtue signal that she was challenging this big, ugly company that she probably didn't even like and probably never drank their beer. And I'm promising you, she got a promotion. She's out there getting high fives from all of her progressive friends because that's what she wanted to do. And I just believe he was virtue signaling and trying to get more attention than Cuomo and Newsom. Remember, Newsom was getting people hauled off of beaches in California. Yeah. A solo surfer. Remember that photo, image of a lone surfer being hauled off by LAPD in a beach in like Huntington Beach? Just crazy. Crazy.
So how close did Murphy come to losing that election?
It was in the tens of thousands of votes.
Yeah. And his opponent was literally a nobody. And he's nobody. His opponent was like nobody. No one ever heard before or since, I'm assuming. So
it was, in the end, it was John Smith. It was the Mr. Smith goes to Washington. It was just John Q. Public running.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Tell us a little about your show, American Stories, which is a weekly syndicated show. What exactly stories do you cover? You don't get into hard politics, do you? This is more of an American tale.
Never. Yeah. No opinion, no nothing. It's the story of America. And it's actually, you're just going to hear a single narrator for 20 minutes or a half hour. It could be David McCullough on 1776. Stephen Ambrose's estate has given a lot of his material. We work with great museums, sports history, business history, you name it. Great stories about a great country.
It kind of reminds me of the Charles Kuralt series that used to be on CBS This Morning. I used to enjoy those. He would go get a slice of Americana and do those, you know, slow little vignettes. Is that basically what you're talking about?
It is. And they're beautifully produced. It's a nonprofit that does the work. Premier Network syndicated it about a year and a half ago. So now we're on every night, 2 hours a night on some of the biggest stations in the country and available on the iHeart Podcast Network as well.
And what have you learned about America through these your program, American Stories? What does it give you hope to fight some of this insanity we've been dealing with, particularly since 2020?
We're doing a story on the year 1864, which is the toughest year but for 1776 in our country. Lincoln's up for re-election. And let me tell you, if we lose a few more battles, McClellan wins for the Democrats, Lincoln loses, and the North just says, we're done with this war, we're finished, let the South secede, we don't care anymore. So we say the nation's never been more divided, but we've been much more divided and we've triumphed. We're a resilient people and we always solve the problems when we've run out of every other opportunity. Always we solve the problem. Always.
All right. Can you give me a time scale? When are we going to solve this? 10 years, 20 years, five years?
New Jersey, I think, could face bankruptcy in the next 10 to 15 years. America's already solving it. What the states are doing right now, how the states are moving on education savings accounts, the story of our lifetime, by the way, education savings accounts.
All right. Well, thank you. Lee Habib, creator, host of our American Stories podcast, weekly syndicated radio show. Thanks for joining Unleashed today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, this is Mark Morano signing off for Unleashed on TNT, today's News Talk. See you next time.